And of course, it was what was particularly important is that this was, of course, almost where we should have started this interview. This is the beginning of the, coincidentally, of the big explosion in biomedical sciences here, people, and then with the with the grand system, and for other reasons, it was, and also the personality of both Harker and Kornberg, particularly, had new people and whose work was so exciting that all kinds of people from all over the world came, and we get them to give seminars, and sort of, it was just a fantastically exciting period, and it gave me a lot of background.
What was the driving force behind the expansion? Was it just the discipline itself, or was
expansion of biomedical science, or of NIH?
Of NIH.
Well, you know, again, that's very hard to say. I think it's mixed. Basically, it was due to the fact that it reflected the expansion, the new techniques, the new field in the field. But you also have to give credit to it, to the various directors, to Dr. Dyer at the beginning, and Dr. Sebrow, and later Dr. Shannon.
Would they have to go to Congress for funding?
Oh, very much so, mm-hmm. Very much so. But Congress was very supportive. But you also have to give them credit for presenting it in the right way. But the interesting thing is that they never lost sight of the fact that they allowed the individual investigator, and I say this very advisedly because things are not always the same now, freedom to do what he wants, and as I say, I'm always amazed thinking back on it, but instead of their saying you do this or deciding that this program or that program should be pushed, they relied on the evaluation of the individual scientists. And I don't think no one's ever told me, and I don't think anyone ever told Rosenthal what he should work on. Now, like every other expansion operation, other factors did come, I'm sure, came in too. It's true of all the government, it was true of a lot of the New Deal operations. People sometimes expand their institutions because of whether it's aggressive is the wrong word, perhaps, but because of the challenge of expansion, because they want to have a slightly bigger operation or a bigger operation, and if it's socially acceptable, it's accepted, mm-hmm. And otherwise it might not be. And so why, when the top people asked for bigger budgets, the exact motivation I can't say, but it was at the right time in the right environment, you see. So when Dr. Sebrow or Dr. Shannon asked for a bigger budget, I'm sure in part it was because they thought it would be good to have a bigger operation and to manage, but if they didn't have if the environment wasn't such that that was good, it wouldn't have been successful. And it certainly was successful, and I think it's terribly important that it was, and Congress was very supportive, and I think all the people concerned, you know, deserve a lot of credit for this. And as I say, it's both intramural and extramural. When you say why, I think why there was all the expansion, I think we get into this more perhaps later when we talk about the journal. There are all kinds of factors, one of which is that these things are autocatalytic, And a lot of it, I think, is dependent on techniques, too.
Mm-hmm.
For example, and this is jumping ahead of ourselves, why do we have so many papers now? And, well, you can appreciate this from your chemistry background, but you can now press a button and get a spectrum across the whole range, UV invisible, or even more, and a better spectrum in a few minutes than would have taken you a month to do it in a much poorer way. And I think this was a factor that facilitated expansion. But more than that, you got awfully good people around. And here we're getting back. The whole thing is like those rubber bands I mentioned before. One thing leads to another. I think for any number of reasons, you've got much better. You've got a big influx of good people working in science. Now, there are any number of factors across the country that made the difference. And I mean, just to list some of them. One people have pointed out to me is the GI Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
It permitted people to get an education, some of whom went into science. Another is a grants program. I mentioned before that Harvard and a few other schools were unique when I was at school and having good science departments. Now, there are gradations, but almost every medical school has a reasonably good biochemistry department. I mean, and each of them is turning out people. And so I think that's important. I think another aspect is, and as you can see, this is an area that I've certainly thought about and wondered why. Another aspect, which I think is not irrelevant, is the fact that as far as I know, there are really no prejudices now in people getting appointments, getting into schools. And of course, even more recently, this all applied, of course, in a very important way to women, which mm-hmm. represents another big influx. And thinking very specifically, since we're talking about the seminar group and so forth, and I bring Arthur Kornberg's name up so much because he represents such an important facet in it. After all, if he was not able to get into medical school and could not have afforded to go to a graduate school, think of how much would have been lost to science and how many people that he's trained would not have been trained. So I think it's this total picture which has been important, and particularly, I would say, the personnel aspect is the most important. Do I make myself at all clear on that? Because I think this is a very a critical point, and has a lot of lessons too.
What about post Sputnik? Did you see any change right after 1957, first when Sputnik went up?
No, but I'm not sufficiently aware of. I think one thing I have to say, in terms of your evaluation of all this, that I really have a double connection to science, and we'll go into that more later. All day I work at the bench, mm-hmm. in an almost old-fashioned kind of, pipetting and so forth, and so therefore I only, and the other part, I'm with the journal and see the total operation, you see, but on a day-to-day operations, unless I hear, read about it, or see anything, I'm not that familiar with the ups and downs, you see, over at least thinking back on it, on the budgets. I would say not. I would say that made very little difference to biomedical science, as far as I could tell. And frankly, NIH the laboratories, despite what people say now, have always been much more poorly funded than the good outside universities. We have much smaller groups, much less personnel, much less equipment. I mean, we're doing all right. I'm not complaining, but I mean, I think we wouldn't. In other words, again, like any government organization, there's a certain stability in it, which is good and bad, so that I wouldn't have noticed any effect of that. But I would guess it probably didn't make any difference.
The reason I use that as a benchmark is because it affected me personally.
Oh, in
the sense that the summer before, I couldn't get any summer support for my graduate research.
I see.
The summer after, there was plenty of money for my summer research.
Yeah. That's very interesting.
And so that's why I wondered.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting you asked that, and I don't know if I'm right or wrong. But I didn't see any real. Mm-hmm. You know. Of course, you might say, if you wanted to answer it in a different way, at that period compared to now, perhaps, biomedical sciences was doing so well in funding that there wasn't the same pressure for more funding than there would have been, say, in another field.
Mm-hmm.
Just to indicate, though, the change in viewpoints, and again, these are small stories, but indicate something. In the late 40s, probably, the director of the Cancer Institute, maybe not the late 40s, but maybe the middle 40s, refused, I think, some small amount of money, whether it was $200,000 or $1 million, I don't know, for fellowships for people in cancer, because he said that there weren't enough people trained to take advantage of that money.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could take that story in any number of ways.
Yes.
He didn't last very long, by the way, for that reason, I think, in part. But you could take that story in several ways, either that he was unimaginative, which I don't think is true, or that he was right, which shows what the situation was there, or a combination of both, and how different it is now, you see. And again, you have to take all of this in the context. Again, I'm coming to the extramural, but also the intramural a little bit, of the fact that extramurally, there was essentially no money whatsoever before the war from the government for any kind of funding. It's just hard to believe that it was all from either local universities or from private foundations, of which there was very little.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes that whole development, I think, of enormous significance. And as I started to mention earlier when I showed you these books, there really is, as far as I know, has not been any good in-depth study report of the kind of things you've been asking me. I mean, one is, why did this increase? And two is, who made it increase? And why was it in the form it was? And it was really a unique situation. And to even expand on that more, we supported foreign laboratories just out of the goodness, really out of just for completely altruistic reasons. I mean, especially after the war in certain areas, this was the only money the places like the laboratories in Israel or Italy or Spain or England, to a lesser extent, but got, and terribly important to these places. It had another interesting aspect that unfortunately has been reversed to a large extent. But when this kind of no strings attached money went to people at some of these foreign institutions, based purely on who was good and who was on the work, it freed them from the hierarchy that was so paralytic. And parenthetically, I think that's true here too. When you ask why do things do so well, it meant that it means now too, but it meant that a young person who was bright and was doing well can get supported and do what he wants to do without being frozen by his department chairman. And that's a terribly important thing. So, again, I'm talking about things now that I'm not that intimately familiar with, except occasionally I've been on committees, or and I, you know, and I know people who've been in the extramural program. But
in many respects, you have an academic setting without students.
That's right, and very much so. And there has been a lot of talk. Dr. Stetten was particularly anxious, and there still is, for whether or not, in some way, a school should be set up here. But there are pros and cons, and But otherwise, I think very much so. We are.
You mean like a Rockefeller, graduate only, or?
No, I think for giving, it's taken various forms of proposals. Yeah. But this has gone back and forth, and I don't know. But you are right. We've tried very hard to give it, and I think the various directors and so forth have been very important in creating the atmosphere of an academic environment. And in my own case, I would say someone like Sanford Rosenthal, who was the chief of the laboratory, was terribly important in that regard. Henry Sebrell, who was director of our institute and later of NIH, was also terribly important, supported Arthur and Bernie and Leon. And then we've had a number of other extremely good directors from that point of view. I mean,
who selects a director?
The secretary, the HHS, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm sure it has to go through the president, too.
Is that essentially a political appointment?
Well, I think you're asking a very timely question. It wasn't until about 10, 15 years ago when it became a sort of, I may be wrong in my facts, but this is roughly the story, maybe 20, 25 years ago, it became a Schedule C so-called appointment, and in which case it's technically much more political. But in effect, on the surface, it wasn't political. And of course, this has been all the controversy, as you know, with the current director, mm-hmm. and how much she reflects the present administration and so forth. And but over the years, it has not been a political appointment. On the other hand, even if it weren't a political appointment, I think there's no question that, and this is, as I say, getting outside of what I really know, there's no question that the NIH is administratively low in the government. In other words, it's in the Public Health Service, which is in the what's now HHS. You see, so that the director obviously has to. The director and all the administrative people have to conform to,
okay.
to all the administrative guidelines, and usually, except on a personal basis, probably have very little access, if any, to the president. You see, so I mean, what you're saying is a terribly important point. Now, it has certain advantages. Again, I'm saying what I don't personally know anything of. The advantages being, of course, that you have the people in the department who are politically astute helping with the appropriations. It has a disadvantage that you're going through another level with whatever they want. But basically, in answer to what you're saying, except on that interpersonal basis, in a purely political sense, I don't think there's been any that kind of politics except in the in what's going on now, because not only in terms of the reflection of the particular policy of the administration, but even the fact that at the end, when there's a shifting in the administration, that the director leaves, by itself is an indication of the fact that now it's in the political arena, mm-hmm. you see. On the other hand, of course, you're dealing with a very big operation, and it's not surprising that it should be reflect the political process. So I think, nevertheless, most of us feel that we'd rather it not be that frankly involved in the politics. Parenthetically, this involves another question, and that is, which operationally gets more difficult, perhaps as the place gets bigger and bigger, and that is, the director has enormous responsibilities for both intramural and extramural, and the extramural on a percentage basis is a much larger money. He or she has the question of, are you just going to support basic research, or are you going to take the broader concept of health care and so forth, all of which is terribly expensive, and I don't think it's from this is a little far from what I would be, from the subject of what we're talking about, but I think from the point of view of the operation of the NIH, these are terribly important questions, and by virtue of that affects the science in the country, because obviously if, even though we're all for doing all we can for everything, you know, preventive medicine or what have you, you could list a dozen things we're all in favor of, that if there's a limited amount of money, obviously that money is going to come from, it's going to decrease the amount of money available for the so-called R01 grants that the universities are so dependent on. And of course, intramurally, it's a comparable question, and there are other questions involved intramurally, such as, do you continue the small investigator, small laboratory arrangement for which the NIH has done so well for NIH, or are you going to have bigger programs with of a more classic sort, like the Human Genome Project or what have you, and so forth and so on. Yeah, how much money goes to clinical research, how much goes to laboratory research. But all in all, the NIH has been extremely supportive of real basic research and basic research thought of and by and chosen by the individual investigator. It's been a remarkable place.
I've got a number of questions at this point. What's been the change in the percentage of NIH grants awarded? As of the applications coming in.
Well, I can't tell you that exactly because, again, I can answer it, of course. Again, as I say, except in terms of my knowing interpersonal, you know, conversations, my own work doesn't involve that at all, in fact, but obviously I'm very concerned about that. No, when I was on the study section, on one of the study sections in 1960 about, I would say about, and the exact figures may be wrong, I would say at least 60% of the applications were approved and were funded. In fact, when I was on the study section, if we felt a application was so poor that it shouldn't be funded, we had to disapprove it. We couldn't have approved it because there might have been enough money to fund it. Now, that isn't to say that it might not have been a good project, you know, you never can be that sure. Now, my understanding is that the figure is down around 10-12%, might be as high, depending on the field. And very good people are not being funded. Young people are not getting grants. More important than that, we might say, is that young people coming up are not going into science because they hear about these stories, they see these stories. Also, I think another aspect that isn't usually spoken of is that people correctly or incorrectly, imagine that they have to go into more applied projects or more fashionable projects to get funded. So they don't do the things that might have led to better results faster, because they're afraid they won't get funded because it uses some, let's say, prokaryote system or something of that sort. I think some of this might be imaginary, but not all of it, and it doesn't matter if it is or isn't. That's the perception among people. I think that's a very serious thing.
Has that change been a steady decline, or has there been any reversal of the percentage, or has it been?
Again, I don't keep up with the figures that carefully, but I would say it's been a steady decline. I don't remember any real reversal. I mean, there have been some temporary changes, but you see, there's a certain buffering here. That's the fact that when people get grants, they get it for somewhere between 4 and 10 years, depending. Usually it's 4 to 5 years, and therefore any individual change sort of and if it goes up at 1 year, it may make it even worse the next year because you've got a carryover. No, I would say all in all, it's been going down. No question, it's been a gradual decrease, and it's a very serious
thing. Is that because, and there's probably no simple answer to it, decreased federal spending, increased budgets for projects because of increased cost there?
I don't think I can really tell you in detail. I think it's a combination of all kinds of things. But perhaps the most important thing is there's a lot of good science, a lot of good people. And this brings up, of course, a conceptual thing. How do you predict how many people can be absorbed or should be? And there's no answer to this. Obviously, if any one good person turns out, say, one good professor turns out, say, let's say if he has 2 or 3, even a low number of, say, graduate students a year over his lifetime, he's put out an awful lot of good. And if it's a good laboratory, each of those are going to have a good operation. I don't know where you draw the line. And actually, this is reflected in, it will come to later, of course, in the size of the journal. I think it's mainly that there's good science, and the question is how much the country wants good science. And for whatever it's worth on the record, I mean, because I think it's terribly important, regardless of how expensive it is, it's cheap. Because if you do any calculation, and the people here at NIH, GMS, and elsewhere have done this calculation, you can calculate that the savings in any one of the therapies that have developed from this research are enormous compared to what's gone into it. And we like to say, and I think we all feel that way, that that you're doing the research for the sake, as we've discussed before, of the that's the motivation, the excitement of science, which is true. But I also point out that there isn't anyone I know who wouldn't be happy to cure cancer. But there's no point in my doing it now, but you can take any of the findings. Just think of a new vaccine or something that's made with recombinant DNA.